magnificent radio. It is completely variable in bandwidth with every aspect, and the color screen, just the scope, the band scope, everything, a magnificent radio. And I had to break in, thank you, Andy, to mention it to the person who was just talking about it, KD2FIU.
FIU, KD2ESY. That was Todd. Todd, that 7000, I haven't seen that one, but the 7100 I wouldn't mind putting in my car. First things first, one step at a time. Sorry, because it has a detachable head, and it does just about everything. All the bells and whistles like the 800. Bill, go ahead.
Yeah, you guys can go ahead and pick it up. I'll be listening. I got to actually make a quick phone call. K2PJD on the side.
Go ahead, Todd.
Yeah, that's definitely a bonus with the 7100. No, it's that detachable head. The radio and the trunk and then the seat, the whole world, you're going to put it out the forehead. The local radio club down here put a couple of 7100s in our EOC, did that because of that fact. So all the radio equipment is at the base of the tower, EOC. They wanted absolutely no RF in the building whatsoever. So they went that route. Wonders what you can do with some networking cable in a little bit of time.
Yeah, Andy, this is KD2FIU again, and I have a 7100 put up last September. I don't mind the monochrome screen. Not crazy about any radios with touch screen. I still like to press the buttons, but the 7100 is a very good performer, Andy. KD2FIU.
I think if I did that route in the car, I'd have to put a screwdriver in it also. You know how much performance you lose using a screwdriver versus the alternative? FIU is still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. But I didn't think that was directed at me because I didn't mention the screwdriver antenna. I don't have one. I don't. I didn't think it was directed at me.
Sorry about that. I was wondering if you knew the difference in performance between the screwdriver and the other antennas.
I don't know. I never used one. But if you're going to, like, say, compare them to ham sticks, which are mono band, the ham sticks can be probably up to 7 feet tall. I would imagine they're better performers being mono banders than 7 feet tall. Now, the full-size screwdriver antenna, which some have mounted to their bumpers or to their frame, since bumpers are plastic now, an extension of the frame coming out of the back of the vehicle. I don't know anything about the performance of them, but I can't really mention it. But I would say that one of the miniature screwdriver antennas would not perform as well as a monobander that's 6 or 7 feet tall.
I'm thinking about the ATAS versus the Chameleon screwdriver, and there's one other.
The Tar-Heel.
Think of the force of them.
Well, who's the original screwdriver antenna? The one with the control unit and the remote. And they make a large and a small version.
I'll worry about it when the time comes.
Okay, you know, the difference is compared to anything, any compromise, a measurement for whatever vein you want, that's going to be different, give and take. Either have a lot of bands in one, or looked at very quickly when I was looking at what I was going to put up for a base. Eventually, stuck and chose on a Z5RV as the alternative with the Dura full band same dipole or a couple of 16 with a switch. So, which way do you want to go? Maybe it's the question.
Yeah, Andy, why did you mention the Yaesu model that you mentioned there? I'm not sure. Why did you mention that one? Were you going to use with a Yaesu radio?
I was just mentioning the different screwdrivers that I have heard of. I don't really know much the difference between them. I know that Yaesu makes that for their radios. I don't know if it really makes a difference what manufacturer you use. Question has to come back to my mind here. I remember. N-stick. I guess that's a single length, single band. That's different than a buddy pole. Is a buddy pole, they're like portable dipoles. Is that correct?
Yeah, the buddy pole is a portable field operation antenna. And, you know, I'm lost on the name of the original big screwdriver. You know, let me go and look at the catalog. I'll be right back. I'm going to head into the next room and pull a catalog. KD2FIU.
The UPS has the original big one. Back of his Jeep. You just said you were a ham for the last couple of hundred years, or was that still?
Andy, this is George. I'm back.
Hey, Dewey, City.
Say something. Come on in.
Yeah, how you doing? You got Tom here, Kilo Hotel Zulu Echo, and Todd's coming through my radio. I'm over here in the Bronx, New York, right across from you guys, near the Brodnick Bridge. And, he's operating my 99, also logged into the 9 remotely, so this is putting on a tripod in the house. We're right across from you guys, over.
Very nice. I got my text license. I guess it was around 6 or 7. The current president of our club, Limark, had a brochure, how to make your UHF ground plane. Got stuck in my attic. Been in my attic with that. I could reach all over the place. And much better, obviously, than just an 8-diamond antenna on it.
All right, no problem. Yeah, I know I'm better in here. Of course, I know Todd. And, like I said, I set this up wrong so people can act remotely. You know, I run a big network and everything, so I do a lot of experimenting and stuff. And thanks to Todd, we've been doing a lot of experimenting, but this is great. And if you guys are interested, you can also check out the radio and how it works and everything. I've never used it before, but it is amazing. Todd's in Pennsylvania, it's over the internet, right in the line out to you guys. No echo link, nothing in between. Works flawlessly. You coming with you. Of course, I need you guys. But so real good. I don't know who's in the room. I'll pass it up to you, and I will pass it around.
Andy, KD2FIU here.
An FIU, I can't remember his first name though. The other room will look something up.
Yeah, Andy, this is George. The name of the original screwdriver was Tar Heel. They are very big and they also have little Tar Heel, which is smaller. These are HF screwdriver antennas for mobile. So if you want to look up Tar Heel, T-A-R-H-E-E-L, and Little Tar Heel, those are the original remotely controlled screwdriver antennas for HF mobile work. KD2FIU.
N1ALF.
One, go ahead. I didn't catch the rest of that. This is Andy, KD2EFI. Then hand it off to Todd.
November 1, Alpha Lima Foxtrot, Alpha. Rob over here in Greenwich, Connecticut, right under New York, Westchester Line, last exit, Merritt Parkway. Also, High Sierra was one of the earlier screwdriver antennas. Very good product. I don't know why they went out of business, but they were very good. Another high-end one is High Q, which called their antennas, which is another good one. So I'm just in there passed by and heard you guys were trying to figure out who was there. But yeah, Tar Heel's good, HiQ's good, and High Sierra went out of business. And Yazoo does make one too. So we'll say 73s. We usually talk to WA to CEL Andy on AM there. We haven't been up that way, I think. So we'll say 73s. Everyone enjoy the evening. And when you left, back to Todd.
A good deal. Yeah. Well, I'm actually going to back out of here myself. I just wanted to jump in here long enough to get Tom on and see if he'd like to make a contact and several. So I'm not sure who's his Mexican version. I'm going to say 73 to everybody for now. And this is...
That's 32KJ, KD2SY. Thanks for coming, Todd. Appreciate it. You have a good evening. George, you said the other gentleman. Thanks for coming out those antennas. George, go ahead.
Yeah, 73 to the guys who were coming in, who were linking in at us. Very good signals over here. Yeah, Andy, I'm sorry I had to go to a magazine because I did forget the name Tar Heel. They're probably the most durably built of the mobile screwdriver HF antennas, and they have a full-size version, and the little LIL Tar Heel, which is a smaller version. Of course, it's not going to give you, I think 80 meters is not included on the smaller version, but they're interesting antennas, you know, little motorized synchronization there with the whip and the inductor and match network at the base, and you know, and the fact that you can remotely control them from inside the vehicle. But interesting, I don't know how well they work compared to a monobander for working HF from the mobile. Over to you, Andy.
Thank you, George. KCUPS has one that's automatic. Question I have using your drivers, not in sync, if it's not resonant, it transmits. Throw up your radio until the antenna catches up to the one to one.
I don't know. I don't know how fast they respond. I don't know whether you just. Well, I imagine you got to hold the power to it in order for it to actually tune. So it's not a matter of just giving it a short burst of power and it going to that frequency. I believe the controller will work in sync with the frequency coming from the radio. I'm not sure of that. But I know there are certain lines of ICOMs and Kents where you can actually throw out a tuning level of 10 to 20 watts with a burst of CW automatically occurring. I know ICOM has that, and some models of Kenwood mobiles, HF mobiles, had that, where you actually hit a tune button. And it's a very low power CW that's not going to hurt the radio until the antenna tunes.
That's interesting. I thought you have to go one band at a time. Ratio is not so bad. I'm not at that question with the driver antennas. Very, very long coil. I'm not understanding how a radio wave wraps itself around the wire again and again. Somehow, electronically, mechanically, syncs with the coil. You know what I'm trying to get at?
82FIU. Well, the way the coil works is it's a circuit or a loading inductor. So the radio wave, well, it's your electronic wave that's using the coil as an inductor. The electrical wave plus the whip is going to use the inductor as a single element of conductor. That single element of conductor is going to generate the electromagnetic wave. So the electrical energy wrapping around the coil
is actually using the coil, not specifically for its length, to add to the length of the antenna, but as an individual circuit called an inductor. That inductor plus the whip now makes your antenna, which is the conductor that converts the electrical energy from your radio into an electromagnetic wave. So I believe the way these screwdrivers work is that a shunting mechanism will travel up the inductor to shorten or lengthen the value of the inductor and the whip above it to make the different size antenna. I don't know if that helps any.
Really, actually does. It saved me from going to one of the seminars at HRU.
Oh, sorry. Oh, I took the joy out of it. What do you think, Andy?
No problem. I did HRU, and honest with you, the topics that I was interested in just seemed pretty drab. I was a little disappointed. It's worth checking out topics next time around twice on how motivated I am to listen to some of these topics. It was not what I expected.
Oh, yeah, well, back to the loaded antenna. This principle I just mentioned also is the principle of a single bander, whereas you would have an inductor at the base and a whip above it. Never mind the screwdriver or the multi-bander. Let's start with a single band antenna, the whip. And since the whip is shortened, you want to change inductance at the bottom to distribute the current at a different resonant level to utilize the shortened whip. So the inductor or the coil at the base is actually acting as a circuit, not as something that's making up for length by its length. Its length, its diameter of wire, its windings, and its spacing is providing an electrical component called an inductor. Inductor plus the designed whip is going to put you on the frequency. Now, going back to the controller.
That makes sense. Should have one of our lecturers at our monthly meetings on antennas explain some of this stuff in very basic terms.
Operations myself, I think I'm probably going to be adding 10 meters by probably May in order that I can capture some 10 meter activity over the summer as we hit the solstice. And we're at the beginning of sunspot cycle 25, so I'm expecting a little 10 meter. Other than that, I only have 2 meter in the car right now. So I want to be able to get me to 10 meters, 6 meters, 2 meters, and 440 in the mobile. And I'm probably going to work them with individual monoband antennas. KD2FIU.
Yes, why? George, are you familiar with the chemtrail?
Negative.
Have you ever heard of them?
I've heard the term. I couldn't give any definition or description about it, but I have heard the term.
I have some familiarity with it. When you look up in the sky and you see those long streaks kind of fan out, feather out, and become really, really wide and long. Those are planes spraying out chemicals. Yes, actually. And there's no secret behind it. I mean, they're talking about it all the time on the internet. They're emitting aluminum, strontium, barium, and other elements for what is falsely considered global warming. They want to reflect some of the sun's energy, but that's a whole other discussion. That's proven. There's no questioning that. My question is, if you knew something about it, when they're spraying this stuff and they blanket the sky at some time, is that going to affect our HF transmission?
I don't know, because I don't have any understanding of the density of the chemtrails. What I was talking about was the sun's X-rays affecting ionization of the gases in the different levels of our atmosphere, notably the upper levels of our atmosphere. Sun's radiation will affect the ionization going on with the different gases. But I don't know the effect of chemtrails.
I'm familiar with the solar radiation. That's not a question. I know that there are layers, multiple layers. One of the protocols for the chemtrails is they blanket the sky at 40,000 feet. Now, that's going to interfere, I would assume, some of our HF cause some interference. Because they're actually blanketing in parts of the sky with elemental particles. So I'm concerned they're going to start to screw up some of the transmission.
I have no understanding or input on it. I don't imagine it to be too much effect, because it takes some pretty dense weather patterns to affect electromagnetic waves at the power that ham radio operators work. And 100 watts, 200 watts is not a lot. And some pretty dense weather patterns are due, mildly affected, but I wouldn't know anything about chemtrails doing it. All right, I'm gonna back off over here and go back and I was on the computer and I want to get in there, finish an article, and shut it down. I should be coming back in a little bit there, Andy. Want to thank you for bringing me into the queue, so. There, because I've been working off of the IC-7000 here since yesterday. It's something that I had on the shelf for a long time. Over to you, Andy.
Your wealth of information. Still a neophyte, even though I've been in for a few years. So information is always greatly appreciated. All right, back to your computer work. I'm going to go in the house. I'm 82, yes. Why, I will be here.
Yeah, and real quick, Andy, as far as what I call the Swiss knife of radios, and that's the all-band, all-mode, all-HF with 6 meters and 2 meters and 440, I think ICOM made the best line, without a doubt. The Mark IIG, the 7000, and the 7100. Just my opinion. And I call them the Swiss knife. Swiss knives. Hey, good talking with you, man. It's been a while. 73KD2, FIU.
Whoever's trying to come in with complete 100% noise. Take care, George. That was 99.5% noise.
KD2 WDR, stand by, listen. Fly Mark TechNet tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2. Net tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W time.
Greetings and Salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy Romeo Oscar Yankee, and I am the net control operator for the Limewalk Technical Net. Limewalk Technical Net has been going on since 1982. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we get together and we talk technology and science and space and all kinds of fun stuff. And I hope you'll come along for the journey and participate as well. Let me drop for a second, and I'll give you the usual information I like to do at the top of the technical net. Okay, if you cannot reach me via radio, I mean, we are available through IRLP, we are available through EchoLink, and we give an audio stream as well, but getting to me, if that's a problem, you can email me. If you have a question that you would like to ask, if you have a puzzle you'd like to share, if you have a topic you'd like to discuss, or if you want me to tap Paul, WS2N, on the shoulder and have him take a look at some NASA or space-related news and give his opinion, the email to reach me would be mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag at, my call sign is alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. Want to keep everyone in mind that I fill up a link page with all kinds of interesting stories. On the top of them are stories that don't lend themselves to a verbal discussion, or their interesting side notes to something I'm going to talk about. The second list is if we get to the science talk segment, which sometimes we do, sometimes we don't, their reference material, and if I don't get to them, you can click on them yourself and read them at your leisure. We also maintain a chat room. You can get there either by going onto Limewalk's website and finding their link and clicking in, or you can type into your own browser in the URL section, chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you right to the chat room. As I mentioned before, we also have a audio stream through the Internet. So if you have someone who doesn't have access to a radio or an antenna, and he can't get in through EchoLink for some other reason, we stream it on the Internet. It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, even though the repeater isn't on that often. And you just type into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the audio stream. And I always want to remind people that MikeKC2NJI maintains an archive of technical nets going as far back as September of 2006. The website is amateurradio.tv. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you what I have planned for you tonight. Okay, as per usual, I will ask if anyone has any questions of a technical nature. I will ask them for their first name and their call sign. I'll put them on the list. And the first people in are the first people that will try and answer. And I'll ask participants and listeners to the TechNet to add their own expertise. Usually we have Andy's Corner. Unfortunately, Andy was called away, so we're not going to have Andy's Corner this Sunday. Hopefully, he'll be back next Sunday. So we'll do our thing until approximately 10:15, give or take, and then we will call upon Paul, WS2N, to do his SpaceNet report. That should take us to the top of 11 o'clock, and I'll come back, tie a bow on it, wish you well, and that will be it for tonight. So that's my plan. We'll see what reality has in store for me. I hope the repeater is well-behaved tonight. So, let us open this episode of the Technical Net by asking if anyone has any questions of a technical nature to ask. Give me your call sign and your first name.
Okay, it's WB2KWC Ken, and I've got some COVID questions, so I'm not sure where they go in the program this evening.
Okay, Ken, I have you down on the list. We'll get to them. It depends upon if there are any non-COVID, more amateur radio questions up front. Someone else was trying to get through. You were doubling with someone. The other person, if you give me your name and your call sign, please.
name is Curtis. Call letters are Kilo Charlie 2, Delta Alpha Whiskey, supporting the net.
Okay, thank you, Curtis. Anyone else out there with any questions, technical questions, amateur radio related, antennas, radios, what have you?
Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu.
Rich recognized. You're on the list, Rich. Anyone else out there want to put their name down? Well, you have a lot of free time tonight since Andy's Corner isn't going to be featured tonight. So please, if you got a question someplace in your head, share it with the rest of us. Okay. Hopefully, as time goes on, we'll have some people come in with questions. We had a gentleman last week who wasn't able to ask his question last week, who I hope would come by this week. So he may yet arrive with his question. We'll take it in order that we got it tonight, even though, Ken, your question is not amateur radio. It's, it's an interesting bunch of questions, and then we'll go on from there to Rich. So, Ken, you want to ask your question?
Okay, and I've got two of them. The first one is, I'm doing some reading about all the different variants. They are, the nomenclature used is something like B.4.A.3. And I was curious of what that means and how is B.4.A.3 different from B.4.A.2, if such a thing exists.
Okay, very good, Ken. Well, the first answer is actually no such nomenclature exists. There are different ways that that people define different variants of COVID virus. There's the politically incorrect way, which is to say the China variant or the Brazil variant or the South African variant. So that's frowned upon. Because too many races kind of go with it and run. And historically, it's been problematic. We've often talked about the 1918 Spanish influenza pandemic, but so far, research would indicate that it actually did not originate in Port Spain, but in actually it exists, it came up into being in Kansas in the United States. So you often get the geographic locations completely wrong. It's more of a historical type of concept. So there's other ways of titling variants. The title that we're all familiar with and that you've mentioned is called lineage, which means that the genetic variations kind of branch off of previous variations. Is a perfectly legitimate designation. It's usually B1, B2, what have you. The remaining designations are all numerals. So you'll have a B.1.1.1. You'll never have a B.C. It has one letter and then up to three numbers. If, unfortunately, your virus is a variation of something that already has one letter and three numbers, you get to put it in a whole new group, which is what P1 is. P1 is actually a variant of something like B.1.14.114.1 or something, and then it's a variant of that. So that's what's going on. It's lineage. You can also describe it by the mutations of the important proteins that it codes for. Very, very commonly, the important variants are due to a mutation in the spike protein that sits on the surface of the virus that everyone's seen the picture of that codes for it penetrating a cell membrane. It locks on to to something called an angiotensin-converting enzyme site, and that's the key that it uses to get in. So the variations talk too much.
So, Ken, did I answer the question before I timed out?
Yes, you did. It had it has to do with the lineage, I guess. And you know, the letters and numbers were purely a figment of my imagination. I just noted the notations. I didn't note whether things were letters or numbers.
NY2H, comment.
Yes, Lou, a comment. I just want to point out that on my link page is a nice little table of contents with some of the really important variant classifications and definitions, so anyone can review them at their leisure. Lou, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, and I think some of the variant nomenclature has to do with the nucleotide changes. So you might have a letter that changed or changed the codon, and some of them can be deletions, some of them could be replacements. So I think that you can actually, it'll tell you what number, if you go across from left to right, was a certain letter and then changed to another letter, or was deleted completely. And for the spike protein, interestingly, they're trying to get a universal coronavirus vaccine, which will still target the spike protein, but rather the ACE receptor, it would go towards the base of the protein, near the cell wall. And not only is the ACE receptor important in the spike protein, but there's a fusion receptor also, which allows the virus to enter the cell.
Yes, you're quite right, Lou. All these variations are variations in the RNA sequence of the virus. They're all genetic permutations. As you mentioned, some are substitutions, where one codon that codes for a given amino acid now will code for a different amino acid that changes the geometry and electrical characteristics of the protein. And others are omission codons, where it turns the codon into gibberish and kind of cancels out that short portion. So, but there are, all the variations are really based on the RNA sequences of the virus itself. By the way, there is other nomenclature for these variants that are more descriptive of what's going on genetically. You'll see sometimes it's written down E484K or B1176F. Those are variations within the spike. The codons that code for the spike itself. And there are a few other, as I mentioned, proteins that are fundamentally incredibly important for the virus to do its nasty thing. But that's a little too complicated for most people, so the press almost always uses the old lineage descriptors. Murray? Yes, please.
Good evening, Charlie, KD2K. I'm just wondering, I know they talk about all these variants, but how are these throughout any flu season?
Okay, well, number one, this is not influenza. This is a completely different group of viruses. They're classed as a coronavirus, but it's a large group, which includes some coronaviruses produce the common cold. They've been around for many, many years. Some people think that it's something as much as 30% of the common cold is another type of a coronavirus. So influenza and coronaviruses are two separate things. Both of them will mutate. And, sometimes they'll mutate into something aggressive, and sometimes they'll mutate into something somewhat less aggressive. Ultimately, over the long term, viruses will tend to mutate to be less deadly but more infectious, and because that's the way it maximizes what it's interested in, which is reproducing its own RNA or DNA, whatever the virus uses. So So they both vary, but coronavirus or the SARS-CoV-2 is much more deadly. Influenza has usually about a 0.1% mortality rate. Coronavirus, this particular version that we've been dealing with, has something like 10 times that or more. So did I answer your question, Charlie?
Sorry, I didn't want to tie up the net. Absolutely. I just think a lot of people aren't aware that, you know, as you said, that these variations are normal, but as you said, much more deadly in the case of the coronavirus. Thank you.
You're welcome, Charlie. Well, you know, I mean, natural isn't necessarily good. There's a lot of natural processes that kill us. So, you know, natural is a mixed bag. Anyone else with any questions on this particular thing that I mentioned? Because I know Ken has one more question.
WTBZ?
Yes, Rich.
I'm just interested in finding out where you feel we are vis-a-vis the vaccines. I have no idea if these vaccines are wiping this thing out better than any scientists ever thought, or where they're disappointed in it, or where do we stand with it? Is this the panacea that we had hoped for? It doesn't seem like so on the media. Maybe that's because some people refuse to take it. But where do you feel we are with these vaccines and what they're doing to the virus?
I think we're doing very, very good. I think that we kind of got lucky. I mentioned in the past that the method that both Pfizer and Moderna used was a somewhat, although it's been around for almost 20 years as an experimental concept, it had never before been brought to a commercial product. So, you know, there was always a chance of a gotcha. And yet, despite that, we have been incredibly successful, both in the amount of time that it was able to be turned around into a viable, efficacious vaccine. And the efficacy has been rather amazing. You know, probably medicine would have been happy and content with something with 70% efficacy. The reported efficacy of the Moderna and the Pfizer is somewhere in the mid to low 90s, which is fantastic. If you take a look at the statistics of the people who, the number of people getting sick and being hospitalized and unfortunately dying, you'll notice a precipitous drop in their age. And the correlation is that that's the age that hadn't yet been vaccinated. So a lot of these things are straight on looking incredibly good. No one wants to kind of, you know, just report success and go away. So they're tempering their bets. They're coming up with vaccines that are more broad-based for the variants, although preliminary studies for the variants show that the presence of vaccines in the United States are effective for them. That might be subject to change. There might be new variants. But I'm incredibly optimistic, and I'm not really an optimistic sort of guy.
Well, on that pessimistic note, thanks, Roy. I hope you're right. I hope the people that choose not to take the vaccine don't negate any good that it's doing. Could that be a possibility?
Yes, that is the big gotcha on a bunch of different levels. The premise is that you want to reach a theoretical herd immunity, a certain percentage, which is different for every virus, unfortunately. And you could make approximations and guesses, but you don't know for sure until you've actually done it and proven it. Of what percentage of vaccinated or already infected and cured you need before statistically it's highly unlikely for the virus to spread in the general community. So you need a herd immunity. Now, the problem with herd immunity is there's going to be a bunch of anti-vaxxers. There's going to be a bunch of anti-medicine people. So that's one limit. There's at least apparently 8% of the population who have taken one of the two shots and have not gotten around to taking the second shot. I don't know if that's something else or they decided that one was fine with them. Now, that will produce a degree of immunity. It will not approach the 94% of immunity, but it might be enough, depending upon how many people are going to be refusing the vaccine. Let me drop for a second, and I'll put an extra little complication on this. Another complication, unfortunately, is you really, really, really do not want a reservoir of unvaccinated people in the third world, because what will happen is the virus will churn through them. And in the same way that India has had the largest incidence of infection, when you have massive infection, you have massive mutations, and you have a much higher risk of more problematic variants. So if we just vaccinate ourselves and treat ourselves like an island and let, say, Africa or South America fend for itself, chances are eventually they'll breed some variant that will be able to jump past the vaccination and hit us again. So the best plan for the long run is to have the entire world vaccinated enough to be in a herd immunity situation.
And the possibility of that happening is?
It's human nature, and human beings tend to make stupid mistakes very often. So to a degree, I see there's going to be pockets again because, you know, there's a lot of people in the world and not so many factories capable of manufacturing vaccines. And these countries are probably going to get it last. It's just the nature of economics, unfortunately. So there'll be an opportunity for variants to screw around with us. Again, if we're lucky, the variants will not be strong enough to jump over the vaccines, as so far Moderna and Pfizer have suggested in their preliminary studies. But, you know, it could change tomorrow. It's a toss of a coin. It's terrible when we have to kind of deal with luck. But, you know, whether we have good luck or bad luck, that's going to make the difference.
All right. Thanks, Roy.
You're welcome. Ken, I know you have a second question.
Okay. Excuse me. Thank you, Roy. I have a friend who is a pandemic denier. It's his opinion that the pharmaceutical companies and Dr. Fauci have patents on the coronavirus, and they're making a big deal about it because they stand to get rich out of the claims that it's a pandemic. I was very dubious about how can you patent something naturally occurring, but doing a little reading, I discovered that there are, coronavirus-related patents, and at that point I stopped understanding what they were saying. Is it possible to patent something like this? And how do I address this person, or do I simply change the subject?
I am not by nature an optimist. So with most of these people, I would suggest changing the subject. If you've kind of drunk the Kool-Aid, you've drunk the Kool-Aid. As someone who has questions, I'm more than happy to try and answer them as best I can. when I answer them and they ask me the same questions and I answer them and they ask the same questions and I answer them, I figure after three times, it's not worth the trouble for either of us. So pessimistically, I would suggest wish him well and don't try and change his mind. Let me drop for a second. Going back to your fundamental question, it is possible to patent genetic sequences. What these genetic sequences that you found most likely are variations on the original SARS virus that have been tweaked to be non-infectious or non-terribly infectious, with the idea being that you could manufacture broken old SARS and inject it as a form of vaccine. Because one of the older methods of vaccination, the earliest method of vaccination, was for smallpox. They realized that milkmaids, for some strange reason, didn't seem to come down with smallpox. And they looked into it. This is back in the late 1800s. They looked into it, and they found that what was happening is the milkmaids were catching a slightly different virus from the cows called cowpox, whose Latin name was vaccinia. And they realized that if they gave people the cowpox, it was enough to, they could fight it off without any of the side effects of smallpox, and it gave them a cross immunity to smallpox. So that was kind of the earliest version of a variation of a virus that's far less dangerous, but is close enough to produce an immune response and a vaccination. So that's the reason for that patent. Let me drop for a second. So you'll find different kinds of patents for the SARS virus. There have been a lot of different coronaviruses. As I mentioned earlier, about 30% of the common cold is due to a distant cousin inside the coronavirus family. The big one that caused a lot of problems was back in the early 2000s with SARS. And then about 10 years later, there was MERS. So these came from animal reservoirs, mutated a form of coronavirus that caused these problems. So there was a lot of research and attempts to make a vaccine. It burned itself out before the pharmaceutical companies could make any vaccine, or they got to the patent and that's it. Fauci, as far as my understanding, he does hold a bunch of patents. They're related to HIV. None of them are particularly related to coronaviruses. I could be wrong, but that's all I was able to find on Fauci. The guy is 79 years old. I don't think he wants to kill millions of people for money at this point in his lifetime. But, you know, paranoid people will be paranoid.
Okay. Thank you, Ray. And I will not take up any more of the net time. Thank you for the information.
You're welcome, Ken. You know, I feel bad for people who believe in conspiracies. Very often they will believe in contradictory conspiracies. I find that it's not like that there's a guy who believes in this conspiracy only. It's usually if they believe in this one, they believe in that one, then they believe in the other one. And if you point out each other, they come up with another conspiracy. So, you know, I wish people well. As long as they don't attack anyone, some paranoids do become slightly erratic. But, you know, if you just kind of keep it to yourself, you know, God bless America, you can have all the conspiracies that you want out there. That said, let's move to another question for the night. Rich, W2BZ. Hopefully that wasn't what earlier you asked wasn't your question for tonight.
No, my question for tonight is about antennas. I had to move my vertical antenna 5 feet to the left of where it was, about the same height, but I had to tilt it to, let's say, the 11 o'clock position. I was talking to somebody earlier on the repeater who said, oh, you sound better, and I didn't tell him that I moved the antenna. You sound better than I've heard you ever sound.